Good morning, folks. If it is good morning with you or whatever time it is, it's always a pleasure to do this. I can't really get over the fact that some people like it, but there you go. It's wonderful. I want to start with a very brief clip building up on something I started last time about the need to rethink the practice of medicine, not from the point of view of particular desires of administrators, but from the point of view of the fact that at its essence, in its essence, medicine is a moral activity, not primarily a scientific or technical one. Doctors have to be scientifically and technically as competent as it is possible for them to be. But the actual practice of medicine, as we know it, was understood centuries before Christ by the Hippocratic physicians, and it is a moral activity. When a patient comes to see a physician, that patient does not have to take the physician's advice. They are free agents. So what is the physician actually doing? Well, I think what he's actually doing is helping the patient to decide what they ought to do. Now, that word ought, we cannot live without it, can we? Can you imagine bringing up your children without ever using the word ought? No, it can't be done. Because unlike the animals who are governed by instincts, we are not governed by instincts in the same way. Sure, we have many instinctive activities that we do, but they're always under the umbrella of deciding what we ought to do. Just think of how un-Darwinian it is to go to war for the benefit of other people, laying your life and your genes in the mud for the benefit of people you don't even know, because you feel you ought to do it. A sense of duty. And a society without a sense of duty will soon fall apart. The criticism of Black Lives Matter can be taken down along those lines very easily. What is the duty of everyone? Certainly not to argue against the current state of affairs by burning the homes and businesses of people who you claim to share the same problems. That's what happened. We made progress over the centuries because we had a moral agreement and we could start working out what followed from that. When Paul wrote, "There is neither male nor female, bond nor free, but we're all one in Christ Jesus," he wrote the death knell of sexism and of slavery, but it took centuries for it to be worked out. But it did get worked out to a considerable degree. Never perfectly. We are fallen creatures. The other great Judeo-Christian insight, which the modern liberal doesn't wish to face, is that our problem does not lie in the level of ignorance, it lies in the level of the will, which we cannot and do not control completely. We can make progress. So, if medicine is primarily a moral activity, it deals with what ought to be done. Now, physical facts don't tell you what ought to be done. You ought to save life, except if you're in a war, and so on. Physical facts do, as some liberals are always talking about, have contexts. But morality has ordering, which we don't talk about at all. And you want your doctor, when particularly you come to the most difficult parts of your life, to share what you probably can't articulate yourself. That's the problem with bioethics. Let me just read you. I came across this week, and it's a book I've mentioned before, but I want people to get hold of. It's called Christian Ethics and Contemporary Problems by Michael Banner. He writes beautifully, but the problem of bioethics is one that's has been annoying to me for a long while. And he begins by going back to Alistair MacIntyre and accepting MacIntyre's thesis that we live in a society without a moral consensus. And in bioethics, they're very liberal, by and large. And so they do the liberal thing of being Brobdingnagians, as in The Gulliver's Travels, building the house from the top down. They decide what conclusion they want and then set about working backwards to what that implies. But this is what Michael Banner writes. I shall allow myself on this issue to refer the reader to a particular volume which, being a collection of essays, has the merit of displaying under one roof, so to speak, the rich variety of intellectual confusion, unintelligibility, an inadequacy which, taken as a whole, is known as bioethics. I think that's the best description I've ever come across, because it's certainly completely true. Now, your doctor, who has no training in that area to speak of, if you ask your doctor what training he had in ethics, he'll say, "Oh, I had a medical ethics course." If you start questioning him about the content of that course, you will rapidly discover there's not very much. It will come down to, in most cases, what I call the Georgetown mantra: autonomy, justice, beneficence, and non-maleficence. Four characteristics, which is the total content of most doctors' intellectual structure for ethics. Now, I have yet to meet an undergraduate student group, including medical school, who have ever been taught to think about the ordering of those things. They look upon them as a kind of smorgasbord where you pick and choose as it suits you as to which is going to be more important in this particular or that particular situation. Is it going to be autonomy, justice, beneficence, non-maleficence, one of the four? Now, I asked them the question, which is the most important of those? Which is the most foundational? And which is the one that is most dependent upon the others? Never had a correct answer. In most cases, not even an inkling of what the question means. So with a little unpacking, one can get there. Remember, this is your doctor, who perhaps does abortions one day and puts premature babies in an incubator on another. He's a confused individual. And he's asked to do that by people like Barack Obama, who made no provision for ethics in Obamacare. It's just, from his point of view, as a reductionist he is, merely a matter of business. You have signed a contract, you must do what the contract requires, and the contract requires that you facilitate, and if it's in your area of expertise, do abortions, and at the same time that you assure the people of the other side that you will care for them adequately, which, of course, you can't live with that kind of contradiction. Now, what they don't understand, and slowly you can pull it out of them, is that the only thing you can really legislate is what we will not accept in this society. It's interesting, isn't it, that society is made stable by what it does not accept rather than what it does accept. Legitimate intolerance is the basis for social stability. Where we did not accept, and there were no excuses for physical violence on women, there were no attacks on women. I grew up in that environment, blue-collar Birmingham, in the late 40s and early 50s. There were no attacks of women on women on the street. It was unheard of. It was something that wasn't done. If somebody did try to do it, the woman screamed, the guy would probably not be alive to greet the police when they arrived. So those absolutes were, in fact, present. And many a boy on that street was rather roughly punished by his father for simply being rude to a lady. You treated women with respect. That was just part of the deal. Now, in England, after the Second World War, the working class hardly went to church at all. But the Bible was still read in school. And so the Ten Commandments, over which Americans currently still have arguments, although their Supreme Court contains an image of a statue of Moses and the Ten Commandments, I believe. But in lower courts, they argue that they have no right to be there. That's historically naive and foolish. But the foundational one is, in fact, those thou shalt not. And the interesting thing is that in Deuteronomy, God doesn't bother to explain why they are so. He simply gives the reason why he should be trusted. He said, "I am the God who brought you out of Egypt," so nobody else could do that. I want you to flourish, and you will flourish if you keep these 10 restrictions on your life, or 10 controls on your life. He doesn't give any rationale for them. He just simply says, "I am who I am, and this is what will make you flourish. And if you don't do it, you will not flourish. You will lose your home and your country, you will go into, you will be enslaved, you will be beaten. And it happened many times to the Jews. They were slow learners on this one. But because they had a covenant with God, they came back. The foundational point of the Georgetown Mantra then turns out to be not the things that the students naturally choose, like autonomy, which they usually put first, or justice, which they can't define, or doing good to people. No, it's what you will not do that's foundational. The things that you just cannot do, there's a voice behind you saying, no way. Every family has those things, if it's a family at all. And if it's a good family, it has the deeply historically based Judeo-Christian ones. Thou shalt not. It's not an imposition. It's a condition of true freedom. You ask the modern student, what do you mean by freedom? Almost invariably, they say, well, the ability to do what I want when I want. Freedom for them is, don't interfere with me. The freedom that the Bible talks about is quite different. It's the freedom to be what you are capable of being if you are obedient. Freedom is the freedom to do what you ought, not the freedom to do what you want. You shall not do, as you are doing, later in Deuteronomy, what is right in your own eyes. God takes a prerogative to define what those characteristics are. So when those foundational thou shalt nots are in place, it's easy to extrapolate to the positives. You can't legislate thou shalt love. You can legislate thou shalt not kill. But you can get by argument from killing to its opposite, which is loving. So that leads you into a description of beneficence, which in the Judeo-Christian environment is something that is taught by narrative, in my view. The children who grow up with all the stories of the Bible have both good and bad examples, and they learn that the ultimate example of love is Christ, self-sacrificial love. We shouldn't look down on these things. Even if you don't believe them, you should be able to see how good they are for children. I am not requiring belief. I am requiring respect, particularly if we claim to be a pluralistic society. I'll be saying something more about that in another context quite shortly. But no, we have good reason to get to our ideas of good and say we should applaud them. And we are made that way. I mean, I really enjoyed in my days as a professor in the department with the medical students, the students who came with me to Africa, who in fact asked me to take them to Africa, they were largely good kids without a Judeo-Christian base to their lives. They were modern baseless secularists. They were facing problems for which they had no foundational support. But they wanted to do good things. And they did amazing things. I mean, and they loved what happened to them. I mean, what I did, I used to call it my medical student abuse program, because I took them to Africa and dumped them in a village a day or two's walk from the road and left them there for 5 weeks. No running water, no electricity, living in a mud hut. Bugs dropping out the ceiling at night, but they all had mosquito nets. And a hole in the ground for a toilet. But it was a transformative experience. The Africans taught them a lot of fundamental things which they had never been forced to think about. And they were honest kids. It was quite common when I went to see them halfway through their 5 weeks, more than once anyway, the students said, when we were doing our surveys of the health of children in the village, when we got to a home, we knew whether the people in the hut were really Christians or animistic pagans without asking a question, because only Christians plant flowers. Interesting correlation. I could talk about that for a long while, but I won't. That view, that understanding, was good for them. They began to think about it. It gave them, for instance, reasons to explain why Africans would walk past a Muslim-funded hospital which was recently and built and looked clean and modern to get to the mission hospital, which didn't have the money and was one of the most efficient organizations I've ever met in the use of money. But above all else, they had an ethos of care which had a history stretching back almost 2,000 years. You can't transpose the techniques of medicine into a culture that doesn't have the history from which that medicine came. Now, that was meant to be a sort of 30-second introduction to the discussion that I want to have as an ongoing part of this podcast for a while about the nature of medicine and how we need to be able to argue on grounds of justice and democracy. Don't bring religion in at first. What I've attempted to do in the preceding few minutes is show you that what your doctor believes and has little understood matters to you. Obviously, if you're about to have your baby and the guy you've been referred to thinks it's perfectly reasonable to destroy babies in utero on Tuesday and deliver them with a smile on his face on Wednesday to mums, or one that finds that very idea that medicine should be involved in the horrific destruction of children, he's abhorred by that. Which one are you going to choose? Their competence is going to be roughly equal. The answer is straightforward. And if we are going to be a multicultural, pluralistic society, we have got to take that seriously and provide for what it naturally leads to. We're doing it in education. The driving force behind the Christian and classical schools and homeschooling and many of the charter schools is Judeo-Christian thought. And it's showing very clearly that it produces much better results than the public system, which hasn't bothered to think about whether there's an ethical basis to education. The same is true of medicine. Now, in the American system, it's going to be easier because you simply have to say that where numbers warrant in any given town that's big enough, you have a practice that holds to the old traditions and those that are liberal in the extreme, and let the chips fall where they will. And we'll be able to look at economies of both, who serves the poor and the underserved, etc., etc. We know what the answer's going to be. Who runs the vast majority of clinics for the indigent poor in North America? It's Christians. Don't pretend otherwise. That's disgraceful. Just think about why that should be so. They're also amongst the happiest places to see medicine practiced.